Okay, for the second last session of this meeting, I'd like to introduce Carl Caves. Carl, I'm sorry, I've forgotten your title as well, but you're going to tell us what it is. Welcome.
There it is. So the mic is working?
Yes, in show now.
Yeah, well, that'll go away in a minute or so, we hope. maybe that's a hint. Anyway, it's good to be here. Some of you will know that I'm on sabbatical at the University of Queensland this year. I spent 7 weeks on my summer break back in the U.S. and just got back here on Friday, actually. And I was very pleased to call home and find for my wife that it was 9 degrees Fahrenheit, otherwise known as about minus 15 Celsius, and this is instant summer. It's nice to be here. So, my talk is about, should we think of quantum probabilities as Bayesian probabilities? And here's the short answer. Yes, because facts that we observe never determine probabilities or quantum states. So different observers have the potential to assign different quantum states or different probabilities in a classical context. So really what I'm going to be talking about is material that was described in this paper with Chris Fuchs and Rüdiger Schock. Chris and Rüdiger and I have been working on this point of view for many years, and I'm going to tell you about a little part of it. I reckon Chris will be talking about other aspects of it. I might just say a little bit about our collaboration before I start. I think all of us once in a while come up with a technical result that's important, but that's not what we spend most of our time on. Chris is an evangelist, and he's passionate about this, and he actually believes he's going to convince you. So remember that. Rüdiger's, well, he might. Rüdiger is the rationalist in our, the cool rationalist in our collaboration, and from the perspective of the third member, if you ask Rüdiger to write a paper and Chris to write a paper on the same subject, you'll get one page from Rüdiger and 15 from Chris, and this causes a certain amount of difficulty reconciling the two approaches. That it's not I that reconcile them. So what about me? Darn, I'm the old fart that's really a nuisance that has to be dragged along kicking and screaming to agree with Chris's latest conclusion. And that's literally true, as he will tell you. But I work hard at it. I don't think I'm going to convince you. And my motivation in this? I just want to get things straight before I die. And time is waning. All right, so you'll see another characteristic of my talks. I always have a series of photographs that tell you which parts of the world I'm passionate about and that signal a transition in the talk. So this was taken in southern Utah. Southern Utah is the most spectacular canyon country in the world. You should go see it. All right, let's talk for a minute just about subjective Bayesian probabilities. And we'll start with a category distinction, which we made in that paper I pointed out. On the one side here are facts, and on the other side here are probabilities. We're going to think of facts as outcomes of events, or truth values of propositions, and the outcome of an event could always be a truth value, that is, the outcome of this event is going to be such and such. And we're going to regard these as coming out of the world to an agent who asks a question to a system. We're going to use the word objective for that. Might not be quite the right word, but that's what we're going to use. We're kind of allergic to ontic and epistemic, so we'll use the old-fashioned words objective and subjective, and they actually, I think, mean something a little bit different, which I could tell you about a bit later. So, probabilities represent an agent's degree of belief in the outcome of an event or the truth value of a proposition, and we're going to regard them as subjective, that is, they're properties of the agent. Something the agent decides. And the important part of this category distinction And the really crucial thing, if we are to maintain the category distinction, is that observed facts never imply probabilities, and hence by extension, never imply quantum states. And perhaps this comes to the point of why we use the word objective as opposed to ontic, and why we use the word subjective as opposed to epistemic. Our view is that if some fact which we extract out of the world actually forced us to a particular probability assignment or to a particular quantum state, then for all practical purposes, that probability assignment or that quantum state are objective. They're out there in the world. We have no choice. It's a meaningless distinction to say that a quantum state that we must assign on the basis of some facts with no choice is either epistemic or subjective. It's objective. And you'll see that arise as we go along. So, and a key consequence of this, and really what it means, is two agents in possession of the same facts can assign different probabilities and hence different quantum states. So there's a summary of our statements about probabilities. Again, probabilities are an agent's degree of belief in the outcome of an event or the truth value of a proposition. We can think of them as a consequence of ignorance, that is, ignorance about the event whose outcome we're going to elicit. And the way we give structure to this notion of probabilities, that is the way a subjective Bayesian does, is to regard all probabilities as betting odds. That is, what we're doing all the time is we're taking in reams of facts from the world, and we're making bets on our own future behavior. We're guiding our future behavior by regarding ourselves as making bets on what's going to happen in the future. And if you take that point of view, that all probabilities are betting odds, then you can use decision theory, which in its simplest form is a thing called the Dutch book argument, which will simply provide rules for manipulating probabilities, rules that you must use if your behavior, betting behavior, is to be consistent. And by consistent, we mean that in one bet, you cannot be put in a situation where you will lose an arbitrarily large amount of money on every outcome. And Chris will give a slightly different take on this, I believe. I don't actually know what Chris is going to say, but I do know he's going to talk about that. So those are objective consequences of consistent betting behavior. And that's what gives the provides the structure of probabilities. You can't just do anything you want with them. You have to use the standard rules. That is normalization, additivity of probabilities for exclusive events, and Bayes' rule for conditional probabilities. All right. So let's look at this a little bit closer. And in particular, one of those rules that we use is Bayes' rule, and that's the way we update a probability assignment based on acquisition of data. So, and of course, we might want to ask, is this whole rule, Bayes' rule, consistent with our idea that all probabilities are subjective? Here's Bayes' rule. We have a set of hypotheses labeled by H. We collect some data labeled by D. We have a prior set of beliefs about the hypotheses, symbolized by this probability. We have a model for the probability of the data given the hypotheses. And here's the posterior probability for the hypotheses. The key point here is that in this kind of classical updating, the posterior always depends on the prior. That is, we would say the posterior probabilities, that is, your updated beliefs, always depend on your prior beliefs, except in this one case when D logically implies a particular one of the hypotheses. So if you write papers on this subject, you could spend, as we did, an infinite amount of time arguing about this wonderful word except. And if you read our paper, you'll see that we adopted a certain way of phrasing what we actually think. And here's various phrases that we could have used.
Can we just delete this?
I don't think we deleted it entirely, but I could be wrong.
Not giving hints of my own.
You mean delete the except? Yeah, yeah.
Delete the whole statement.
Don't
let me
interrupt. Well, you already have. But that's all right. That's what this is about. I think we deleted the except. Here's one take, which actually I favor. I probably still favor, although I was browbeaten into not favoring it. Facts never determine non-trivial probabilities, by which we mean ones that aren't certainty. And the reason I like that is because it doesn't really have any effect on quantum on our application of this to quantum mechanics, because all quantum states predict some probabilities, so facts never determine them. However, that here's perhaps a better response to this except. The posterior depends on the model, even in this case, and the model, of course, is a set of probabilities, and from our point of view, they have to be subjective, so there's still a subjective element in the posterior probabilities. But I believe this is what Chris is referring to. We just left it out because it's irrelevant to the quantum mechanical discussion anyway. If you want to discuss it with me, I'm happy to. But I think it's irrelevant to the rest of the talk. So that's a little discussion of subjective Bayesian probabilities. They're always gambling odds, or betting odds, given structure by consistent betting behavior through the Dutch book argument. There are, of course, other views of probabilities. There's the idea that there are objective probabilities, that is, probabilities that are either properties of systems or sometimes it's said properties of the relation between the agent and the system. And one of the most popular of these is the objective Bayesian way of assigning probabilities. And we heard a little bit about that yesterday in Howard's talk. Probably the most secure objective Bayesian principle, maybe even the only one, is that symmetry implies probabilities. So if you have some group under which your alternatives are invariant, your probability distribution should be invariant under that same group. And the simplest use of that is the original principle of indifference. If you have no reason to favor any of a set of alternatives, you'll assign equal probabilities. Probabilities is frequencies. That's certainly the oldest method of thinking of probabilities as objective. That is, you can actually determine probabilities by making measurements on identically prepared systems. And that makes probability a verifiable fact. And then another view is objective chance. There's perhaps a little difference between that and propensity, but I would find it hard to tell you what that difference is, so I've just lumped them together. And this is probably as a sort of specified fact. So what do we say about these ways of thinking of probabilities as objective? Well, this first one's pretty easy to get rid of. We're perfectly happy for someone to apply. You will notice that I like to walk around when I'm giving a talk, so I'll have to think about
that.
Just that way from the speaker.
I've got it. Yeah. All right. We're perfectly happy for people to apply symmetries to their probability assignment, but the symmetries are always applies to your judgment, not to the alternatives. That is, if the alternatives can even be numbered, then they're distinct. And your symmetry argument is really a statement that your judgment about those alternatives is invariant under some group, and then you'll get a symmetric probability assignment. But that's a judgment, so the probability is still subjective. It's not somehow something that exists in the system itself. The probabilities is frequencies. That's really the one that's easiest to get rid of, and it's kind of a dead horse to be beating on it, but there is a reason to beat on it here. If we want to try to verify probability as frequencies of outcomes in successive trials, we actually have to introduce a bigger sample space. And in that bigger sample space, we have to make additional assumptions about probabilities, the assumption that allows you to use frequencies of outcomes as a sufficient statistic is the assumption of exchangeability introduced by DeFinetti. And so because you've introduced a bigger sample space, you aren't actually verifying your original probability assignment. You're actually using a more an additional set of judgments to hone in to improve your ability to predict future trials in a long sequence. The reason this doesn't work in the end is because frequencies are facts, not probabilities. They're the things we extract from systems, and frequencies are important in situations where, in our judgment, we can make the exchangeability assumption so that frequencies are the only thing that counts, not the individual sequence of outcomes. There are a lot of people who, even though they accept these arguments, would say, but maybe in quantum mechanics, we can nonetheless derive the quantum probability rule from frequencies because there's an additional structure in quantum mechanics, that is the Hilbert space structure and the inner product. And that's a thing with a long history, and Rüdiger and I decided to examine that. And I believe we did a pretty good job of demolishing the idea that frequencies in an infinite number of trials can be used to derive the quantum probability rule. So I'd urge you to look at that if you're interested. So objective chance is probably the one that's most relevant to us here. And a propensitist would say, well, some probabilities are ignorance probabilities, that is, we don't know the true alternative. But some probabilities aren't of that sort. Some probabilities are specified by the facts of a chance situation, and the facts of that chance situation, the probabilities are actually a property of the facts of a chance situation. Well, the reason this in classical physics runs into problems is because in classical physics, and this is something that we were discussing earlier today, let's say we're flipping a coin. If we know enough about the initial conditions, there's no chance left. We can predict with absolute certainty what the outcome will be. So defining a chance situation is a difficult thing. You have to have an objective way of saying why successive flips are the same, and yet if they were exactly the same, you get the same outcome in every trial. So you have to have an objective way of saying why they're the same and why they're different. And they're different because in practice, when you flip a coin, you use different initial conditions on different trials. And in the end, the equal probabilities for heads and tails comes about because it's your judgment that you sample enough of the initial condition space that the two outcomes are equally likely. There's simply no way to make that into an objective statement that without referring to probabilities. You can't make a statement that all the different initial conditions are equally likely without invoking probabilities. I just did. So inevitably, objective chance founders on the idea that you have to say that all the different all the different trials are the same but different, and that's a tough one. On the other hand, in quantum mechanics, we think we can prepare systems reliably. I mean, if we prepare them with all the information we can, we prepare a pure state. And so there it would appear that we can say, oh, all the preparations are the same, and different trials can have different outcomes if we don't measure in the basis that includes the prepared state. So a propensitist typically, you can argue with them for a long time, and they give ground slowly on these points. But ultimately, if they do give ground, they'll just say, well, quantum mechanics is the place to look for probabilities that are objective chance. Now, that's a terrific place. If you haven't been there, you should go. It's your country. First-class scenery. So now what I'm going to do is the following. So this is a talk that I almost never give, but I like to give it. But I don't have much opportunity to give it. Basically, what we're going to do is the following. We're going to start out with the state spaces for classical, that is, realistic and deterministic views of the world, and quantum mechanics. The state space in the classical world is, we can think of that as being microstates, that is, individual distinguishable alternatives of a classical system. Or if we're willing to introduce probabilities, we can think of ensembles of these microstates characterized by probabilities. Comparable things in the quantum world are, the space is the convex set of density operators, the extreme points are the pure states, and we can have ensembles of those called mixed states. And just from the way I've described it there, your initial reaction, and one that's pretty common among physicists anyway, is to think, microstates are objective, those are real properties of classical systems, probabilities are subjective. I mean, you might get some argument about that, but we'll adopt that point of view. And if you just transfer that over to quantum mechanics, the pure states are objective and the mixed states are subjective, let's go home. Of course, that's not what I told you I was going to talk about, so I must have some reason for thinking otherwise. But ultimately, all questions about subjective probabilities in quantum mechanics have to do with, should we transfer these properties of extreme points, that is, microstates classically, to the pure states quantum mechanically? And obviously, I'm going to argue that you shouldn't. And the way we'll do that is we'll have a kind of scorecard. That is, we'll look at a whole bunch of different things that we can think about for these two settings and see, what things are similar here. So we'll look at predictions for fine-grained measurements. Quantum mechanically, that'd be von Neumann measurements. We'll look at verification of states, we'll look at state changes on measurement, we'll look at uniqueness of ensembles, we'll look at non-local state change, otherwise called steering, and we'll look at specification of states, that is, state preparation. I could heap scorn here on the word steering, and I'll tell you more about that later. Steering suggests that I'm sitting here and, I do something, and something back there does something in response, so it kind of builds in the idea that there's something objective. But the reason I don't want to heap too much scorn on that is the whole notion of using the word state and state space has already prejudiced you to think everything's objective. And we really need to get rid of that, but that's probably a lost cause during my lifetime. So, I mean, if I was writing a dissertation, I might get rid of that, but it would have no effect. All right, so let's start out looking at fine-grained measurements. All right. We know if we have a system that's actually in a microstate, then we have certainty. If we make a fine-grained measurement, we're going to get that particular result. If we have an ensemble, we'll get probabilities. If we have a mixed state, we're going to get probabilities for everything. But if we have a pure state, we're going to get either certainties if we measure in the right basis, or we're going to get probabilities. So that doesn't really tell us so much. And probably most physicists would still be pretty committed to the idea that pure states are objective. They wouldn't change their opinion after looking at this. I made objective in standard font instead of bold because you might have had the slightest, if you didn't know anything about quantum mechanics, the fact that you get probabilities from these extreme points might have shaken your faith in the objectivism of that a little bit, but probably not much. What about verification or state determination? That is, if we have a system in a certain state, can we determine that state? Certainly if it's an extreme point in the microstate, classically we can. We just make a measurement, we find the state, and that's it. We've already heard this morning far more rigorous ways to state that kind of thing, but rigor's not my strong point. So if we have an ensemble, that is a set of probabilities, we can't verify those probabilities in one trial, and we've just seen if we try to do it using frequencies, that involves additional assumptions, which means you're not really verifying the probability distribution you started with. You have additional judgments that have to go into that. And over here, you can't verify a pure state in one trial, and of course you can't verify a mixed state in one trial. Again, you can try to do many trials, but that involves making additional assumptions about the state you assign to the many systems. So you're not really verifying that particular pure state. So a nice way to state this is, whom do you ask for the system state? Well, in this case, you can ask the system, but in every other case, you better ask the agent who assigned the probabilities or the quantum state, because you're not going to get an answer from the system. So maybe people who believe in objective states might be a little bit, they might now be thinking maybe there's something to the idea that subjectivism for pure states makes sense. Let's look at the state change on measurement. Well, again, classically, of course, you could have a state change on measurement if you measure a system which is known to be in a microstate, but you don't have to. In all these other cases, there will be a state change on measurement. It's inevitable. And quantum mechanically, that's the famous state vector reduction or wave function collapse. And if you want to maintain your objective views, this is probably the best way to deal with it is to say there's a real disturbance due to the measurement. It really gets in there and changes things. And the standard excuse would be, well, there's the quantum of action. That's such a small scale. You can't make your disturbances smaller than the quantum of action, so there's always a disturbance. That really doesn't cut any ice when you start thinking about pretty macroscopic systems like a squid that are in superpositions, because you're really making a squid that's in a superposition of current going in this direction and this direction. The quantum of action is nothing compared to the difference between those two, and so it doesn't really cut so much ice. Yeah.
So on your verification scorecard point there, it's certainly true if all the possibilities are all of the states, right? It could be any pure state for that many classical and quantum are different. But what do you think about unambiguous discrimination? The fact that any two pure states, any D linearly independent pure states, can be unambiguously discriminated, which is certainly not true for ensembles.
With a failure mode, yeah. So I wouldn't say that you've actually verified the state in one trial.
But you have some probability of doing so, which is not true of ensembles.
Yeah, that's true.
But it is true of ensembles that have compact support, that 100%.
Yeah, that's certainly true, too. Well, we could come back to that if you want, but we'll continue with the scorecard. At this point, most people who want to maintain the objective, well, they just put in a real physical disturbance, but they still might be thinking that maybe there's something to the subjective view. This is the one I really like, uniqueness of ensembles. If you believe that underneath a classical system is the real thing, the real microstate, and you want to transfer that to pure states, that is underneath an ensemble of pure states is a real pure state, then there ought to be a unique pure state. But the problem is ensemble decompositions here are unique because this is a simplex and they aren't unique here, so there isn't any real to it. Essentially any state that's in the support can be of the density operator, can be your real underlying state of affairs. And of course, we're all familiar with that. These no's are because if you have ensembles in terms of either distributions or density operators, they're not unique either. So we all know this. If a probability distribution sitting here in a three alternative case, 1/2, 1/4, 1/4, the probability distribution is has a unique convex combination in terms of the extreme points, but it's got lots of other convex combinations in terms of probability distributions themselves. And over here, of course, here's the black sphere, and you have lots of ensembles that can give you that density operator sitting at that point in block space. So at this point, I think, let me have one little caveat here. Another way to react to this sort of thing is to say, well, there aren't any mixed states, period. Mixed states only arise because we have a bigger system that's in a pure state, and that pure state is the real thing. And we trace out the rest of the world, and our system ends up in a mixed state. And I think that's certainly an approach. It is the approach that underlies many worlds interpretations. I call it everybody calls it the going to the church of the larger Hilbert space. I just want to emphasize that really, if you're going to go to the church in this context, you have to go to the universalist church of the larger Hilbert space, because in the end, there's no stopping. There's no stopping this backing up and including more of the world. You've got to get to the whole universe before you're finished. And so in the end, you're going to have a universal wave function. No other way to do it. Aside from that, I'd say this is getting to be a pretty good argument. If we're going to regard pure states as being the real thing, then surely there ought to be a unique real thing underneath the density operator, and there isn't. So Now your original objectivist has gotten to objective, and it's now all green, and there's only just one further step to be made, and you're all on my side, so let's do it. What?
You said you weren't going to convince me.
Well, you'll see. We're not. In the end, the question of non-local state change, that is, state change from afar, where we have no mechanism, we don't know of any mechanism that produces a disturbance. This is just the same old argument we had to start with about state changes on observation, except we want to change the state of a distant system, and we have the additional fact that we have no mechanism for a disturbance to go from one to the other. So I don't need to go through these detail. Everybody knows this. We can't change the distant microstate of a classical system in this way, but in all of these cases, we can steer distant probability distributions or different quantum states. We've heard a lot about that here, and I'm not going to go into much detail, but it can be done. So at this point, a lot of people... So now if you want to believe, if you want to be an objectivist, you have to believe in a real non-local physical disturbance that actually changes the state on the far end. And this is getting to be harder to take, and so we're going to assume that now the original objectivist is converted. Although, you notice that's in standard font instead of bold, so you know, you're reserving a little bit of leeway to convert back. So let's look at the last thing, which is state preparation. So the question is now, can we prepare these states, these different kinds of states, reliably based on classical facts of some preparation device? And it is a standard feature of Copenhagen interpretations, I believe shared by all Copenhagen interpretations. In fact, I would say that this is the main feature of Copenhagen interpretations, that classical facts specifying the properties of the preparation device determine a pure state. Okay? So now, if you believe that, oh, and I should say, in the paper I referred to, you won't find the use of Copenhagen much because Chris thought we were browbeating Copenhagen too much, and so we changed the name of it to what do we call that?
Objective preparations.
Objective preparations view. We didn't even call it an interpretation. It's just a view. if you adopt this, then in this interpretation, yes, you can reliably prepare a pure state. And you can also reliably prepare mixed states because you just prepare a bigger system and trace down to a smaller system. So you're kind of set now to say, I'll get to your question in just a second, Howard. There I have it, the objective preparations view. Copenhagen becomes the place where objective chance is. And here's the point that I started out with. If you are forced to assign a particular quantum state based on facts of a preparation device that you gather from a preparation device, then there's really no point in calling that anything but objective. The state's nothing but objective. It's out there in the world. There's no choice about what it is. And so in Copenhagen, you're back to all of these guys being objective, and of course that's consistent with our idea that of mixed states and pure states. Really, you can't have a different view about mixed states and pure states because of the non-uniqueness of ensemble decompositions. If you're going to say one's subjective, they've both got to be subjective, and the same with objective. Yeah, so there was a question.
Yeah, so I don't understand why you have another book, you know, classical ensemble. I mean, what do you mean by, what's wrong with random number generators?
Yeah, there's always judgments about how a random number generator works. If it's a pseudo-random number generator, actually you can get inside it and there's no probabilities at all.
Yeah.
And since classically there isn't anything but pseudo-random number generators, yeah, it's a judgment, ultimately. Now, there are some very tricky points there that I could discuss, but in the end, I think we believe there's always a judgment behind assignments of probability distributions. All right, so now this Now, this is a surprising conclusion, but I believe this is what defines Copenhagen. And so now let's look at what we did. Here's the entire scorecard. In every way, extreme points classically are different from extreme points quantum mechanically, except down here where we can prepare them both. And that's what Copenhagen lets override everything else, and in the end, states are objective. So what does a subjective Bayesian say? Well, let's look at classical and quantum updating. Here I've just repeated what I said before about classical updating. And there's a similar procedure quantum mechanically, which is based on, so any dynamics can be used to, can be put in this formalism, but what I have in mind here is trace decreasing dynamics corresponding to some kind of actual preparation. So there's our prior, an initial quantum state. There's our quantum operation, which is our model, like the conditional probability. And here's our posterior quantum state, conditioned on the data D that we gather. And we're going to focus in on a particular kind of quantum operation, which is one where rho sub D does not depend on rho. So you prepare the same state regardless of what the input is. So an example of that would be, this would be a projector under a particular outcome. So that would seem to be a case where, this is where Copenhagen will say, well, if you specify your device and you collect the data from a projective valued measurement, you know the state afterward, there's no choice. What would we say? The posterior state always depends on prior beliefs, even for a state preparation device, because there is judgment involved in choosing the quantum operation. And let me just say what that judgment comes down to. There's our slogan, but let's say a little more than that slogan. What the Copenhagen interpretation forgets, of course, it doesn't really forget this, because in the original formulations anyway, this is built in from the start. It forgets that the preparation device is quantum mechanical. And if you want to provide a detailed description of that device, you have to say what its quantum state is. And ultimately, a detailed description of the preparation device involves prior judgments in the form of quantum state assignments to it. And that's something you can prove. It's not a hard thing to prove. I haven't managed to interest my collaborators in the proof of it, because they probably either think it's obvious or pointless, but it is something you can prove. That is, the device that always prepares the same state won't operate the same for all possible states of the device. And that seems like a pretty reasonable conclusion, and you can show it. So what does the subjective Bayesian view? The subjective Bayesian view has the scorecard being exactly the same as before, except it denies that you can reliably prepare either pure states or mixed states. That is, all those cases where you're darn sure what the pure state is, we would say, fine, you're darn sure. But that state is not something that's dictated by the properties of the device you used and the data you gathered from it. And now I think the scorecard's pretty clear. The only case where there's any similarity between pure states and microstates classically is here. And, you know, the scorecard's pretty clear. Quantum states are subjective. Now, Chris will have a more poetic way of saying this, or so we hope. I'm going to go on and do something else. What do I have, about 5 minutes?
You've got more than that, actually. You've got 15, 20 minutes.
Really?
Yeah. Unless my watch is wrong. Possible.
Ah, well, then I don't have to rush through this, which I wanted to do, because otherwise people might ask me questions about it. This is another picture out in the Bungles. God, you really need to go. It's just world-class scenery. All right. So, what does this view get us? Well, it gets us a lot of things. And I want to just give you one particular thing that the... one particular way in which I think the subjective Bayesian view of quantum states actually clarifies something. And that is the question, is a quantum coin toss more random than a classical one? Or, to put it differently, why do we trust a quantum coin toss over a classical one. Well, let's just first say what we're talking about here. Let's say we have a system that's in the spin-up state, a qubit that's in the spin-up state, equal superposition of spin x and minus x. So if we measure spin up, of course, we always get up. But if we measure spin sideways, we get there's our quantum coin toss. That is, we get with equal probability plus and minus. So the standard answer for why the Copenhagen answer for why we trust this quantum coin toss over a classical one is something like is the idea that quantum pure states are objective. They could either give rise to certainty or to probabilities. And because they can give rise to probabilities, we can reliably prepare them. They can give rise to probabilities. And so we know this probably is a property of the world, and nobody can question it. And therefore, that's a darn good coin toss. That seems like a darn good answer. It's the same thing we started with, that it looks like, or at least I started my abstract with, the standard view would be that quantum states are part of quantum mechanics, and these probabilities are guaranteed by physical law. So therefore, that's the reason we trust them more than classical probabilities. So what would be the subjective Bayesian answer? Well, the subjective Bayesian answer would be that we can give a very short version of the answer by saying that there's no possibility of inside information. So I'm going to explain what that means. There's no possibility of, not that there's no possibility, I'll have to say a little bit more about that. Let's just leave it at that. No inside information. And we'll say something now about what that means. So let's define the concept of inside information. And I did change the belief. Change this to privileged beliefs and so on. But you know, in the end, and that's all based on the fact that information. I mean, we prefer to use the word belief over either information or knowledge. But in the end, that seemed so forced that I'm going to use inside information, whether Chris agrees with it or not. It really only matters whether Rüdiger agrees, because he and I are going to write the paper. Anyway, what we mean by a party B, let's say, having inside information about an event E relative to party A, that is inside information on party A, is if A is willing to agree to a bet on this event, the outcome of this event, that B believes to be a sure win. So this can certainly happen classically if I have a set of alternatives and the support of my B and A's probability distributions look like this. So they have some common support in the middle. And then on the outside, there are outcomes that one party believes to be impossible that the other party believes to be possible. And then one party can get the other party to bet on those things which he believes to be are a sure win. Doesn't mean they are a sure win, but he believes them to be a sure win. That's what we mean by inside information. We call it inside information because that deals more with the case where the supports look like this. One side's support is inside the other. So the party with the inside support has inside information and can get the other guy to bet on things which he knows to be impossible, or he certainly believes to be impossible. And those kinds of insider attacks, those are pretty common classically. In every case we've discussed classical probability distributions, either in a coin toss or in a pseudo-random number generator, there is the possibility of an inside attack. You can get inside the pseudo-random number generator and figure out how it works, and then you can win all the bets. Or you could have a darn good way of seeing what the coin's initial conditions are and do it. And you know, this is not routinely done in casinos, but people have done it successfully in casinos at the risk of life and limb, because typically they're chased out after having their heads bashed in. But you can do it. People have won by having inside information either about roulette wheels or, roulette wheels is the only reason. You can win on blackjack as well, but that's not really inside information. That's just being smart. So inside information is an important thing. So quantum mechanically, if I have one guy assigns this pure state and another guy assigns this pure state, not orthogonal, each of them has inside information on the other, because each can find an orthogonal alternative to their own pure state, which the other side will bet on and which that side believes to be impossible. So what we really need is the concept of one-way inside information, where one party has inside information on the other and not the other way around. And so that's just defined here. And it's real easy to show that in quantum mechanics that B has one-way inside information on A if and only if the support of B's density operator is a subspace of the support of A's density operator. It's a trivial thing to show. So, the unique situation in which no other party can have one side information on you, U being called Z here, is when a Z assigns a pure state. So, Z is then said to have a maximal belief structure that assigns a pure state. And no other party can have inside information on you given that state assignment. And that's the reason why we trust a quantum coin toss over a classical one, because in all classical coin tosses, unless it's not really a toss at all, that is, the outcome is certain. For any classical coin toss where there is a probability, where you believe there is a probability for one outcome or the other, somebody can have inside information on you. And in a quantum coin toss, the beliefs that lead you to the pure state assignment rule out the possibility of somebody else having inside information. Now, of course, you could be wrong, and I use the word wrong advisedly because you're not really wrong. You made a judgment. But it could be that somebody else has a judgment that assigns a different pure state, which works out better. And so you could still lose. But when you certify to yourself that something's a pure state, you are certifying that you believe nobody else can do an insider attack on you. And that's the reason you trust that kind of coin toss more than a classical coin toss. Now, one way of illustrating why this is really about beliefs is, let's say you took, so who makes these quantum coin tossers? Does Jisan make them? Yeah. So let's say you took one of Jisan's machines. Sells them. Yeah. So let's say, I don't know what the rules of Australian football are. I'd use that as an example. But let's say in the NFL, American football, let's say they trundled out one of Jisan's machines. Before an American football game, you flip a coin to see who gets to receive the ball first. There's another option, but it's irrelevant. So let's say the two coaches were out there, and you trundle out Jisan's machine, and the referee brings out a coin. Which one do you think the coaches would go for? I can guarantee you they'd go for the coin, because they'd think the other team has some in on the Jisan machine. So it really is a question about beliefs. You and I might believe that quantum coin tosser is better, but an NFL football coach, he ain't going to believe that. I can see Rob is, it's a stupid example, but I do have 15 minutes, so I couldn't resist throwing it in. All right. So there's an example where I think the subjective Bayesian approach actually makes us think harder about why we think something. That is, why is a quantum coin toss better than a classical coin toss? And really gets to the heart of the issue. Instead of this, it's physical law. Now, this photograph is to show you I actually like where I live as well. It's not just Australia, but I do love being in Australia. No.
You have
15
minutes.
No. I was up there recently, but it was covered in snow when I was skiing. I had about 5 feet of snow on it.
I know it's a common property of rocks.
Well, that's true. I do like rocks. And if you came to my house, you'd see that I don't like vegetation. And it wasn't Aussie who told me one of my favorite slogans after I'd been to New Zealand and it rained on me all the time I was there. I visited this Aussie in Canberra and he said, if it's green, it rains too much. And I fully endorse that point of view. All right. I'm going to take a stab at ontology. Because if you listen to any of us, and you probably mostly have listened to Chris, You might have also heard a talk by Rüdiger. You will always hear us say, well, we're not just in this to tear down everything and make everything subjective. We're interested to find what are the subjective features of quantum mechanics so that we're then left figuring out what are the properties of the world in the quantum structure. So I'm going to take a stab at that. And here's my stab. Quantum systems are defined by attributes. I don't want to call them properties, but attributes like the fact that a quantum system can have a position is an important thing in telling us what its Hilbert space is. That is, it can have a position-momentum pair. That's an important thing in telling us what its Hilbert space is like. Or angular momentum for a spin, and energy, or the Hamiltonian. If a quantum system has these attributes, which we can discover, and if we don't have those attributes, that if we don't know them, we just simply don't know how to address a quantum system or work with it. In fact, you could say that almost all of physics is about discovering what these attributes are for physical systems, fundamental physical systems. And I'm going to say these attributes are objective properties of the system. The fact that the system has these attributes and not some other set of attributes, that's an objective property of that system. Of course, the value assumed by an attribute is not an objective property. And the quantum state that we use to describe the system and hence to provide probabilities for outcomes of observation of these attributes, that's not an objective property either. The value is not an objective property. The fact that the thing has a value structure in Hilbert space that corresponds to one of these attributes, that's the important thing.
So would it be clearer to say these attributes are an objective property? It sounds like you're saying that the thing that is objective is the list of attributes, the set of attributes. Whereas saying these attributes are objective properties is confusing me. Can I resolve that confusion by saying the way I said
it? Try it on me again. I didn't quite...
I think what you mean here is that if I were to write down the list of attributes, right, this system has angular momentum, position, blah, 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 then that list is an objective property.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Instantiations aren't objective, but the properties themselves are matters of fact. The attributes themselves are matter of fact.
So each of them, or the whole collection, sort of, say, the commutation relations, position, momentum, are something objective, or is self-adjoint operator position.
No, I would say the collection of them and their properties in quantum mechanics, because among other things, what these guys will do, the numerical particulars of their eigenvalues and the numerical particulars of their eigenstates, that's what defines the structure of matter. And so I'd like those things which follow from these attributes, those are crucial. Yeah. Yeah, I would say that, yeah.
You say there is?
Yeah, I think I would. Until I ran into trouble with saying that, and then I'd think harder about it. And, you know, the whole history of thinking about this kind of stuff is anything you say gets you in trouble. So that's fine. Yeah. But. I should say that if I show one more transparency, I'll be finished, and then I can just answer all the questions. So these are kind of things that I said that favor this point of view. The attributes orient and give structure to a system's Hilbert space. Without them, we're clueless as to how to interact with a quantum system. So I think it's crucial that quantum systems have, that these are properties, and these properties are what allow us to interact with a quantum system. The attributes are, well, that second one, the attributes determine the structure of the world, that's what I just said. And the unchanging properties of a system which can be determined from facts, that's kind of a, that's just a claim on my part. I'd really like to show that. Chris and I were discussing that at lunch. It's very hard to think about, you can either adopt that as an article of faith.
What would you like to show?
I'd like to show that there are unchanging properties of a system which can be determined from facts. Involving no judgments. That's this. So this is a statement. It's a claim at present. I don't know how to prove that. And it's very hard to think of how you would devise an experiment where you actually determined these attributes without having some judgments, that is, some quantum states behind it. On the other hand, that's what physicists do all the time. Of course, we may be making a big mistake, but that's what we do. We determine attributes of physical systems, and we determine their Hamiltonians, and that's the way we make progress in the world. Doesn't mean that that statement is true. Let's see. One of the reasons I like for putting the Hamiltonian in is there's two ways to identify the Hilbert space for a system now and later. You take the attributes and you just, outside of the Hamiltonian, just map it up from one to the other. That's the Schrodinger picture. No, sorry, that's the Heisenberg picture. And the other way is to evolve the system under the Hamiltonian. That's the Schrodinger picture. And the crucial connection between those two ways of doing things is provided by the Hamiltonian. That's why I think Hamiltonians are objective properties of systems. And then the final thing, this is here really just for Chris, but he knows that at least I think this is true. Heck, I probably don't need the rest of the talk. Yes, I won't bother to go back to the other mode. Convex combinations of Hamiltonian evolutions as functions of time, you can show those convex combinations are unique up to degeneracies in the Hamiltonian. So in the end, these are to some of this I can actually show. Some of it's just statements. Here's my what I end up with is questions. Why should you care? Well, maybe you don't. And my answer to that is if you do care, how can I make this point of view convincing to you? What would you need to know? That I'd like to know, and maybe I'd work on it. This particular way of dividing things up leaves quantum operations in a real mess. We've already said that state preparation operations have to be, that is, ones that reliably prepare particular quantum states, those have to be subjective. If they're not subjective, then we take an input, we get a reliable output, and it's then an objective property of that preparation device. On the other hand, the quantum operations that correspond to Hamiltonian evolution, according to me, those had better be objective properties. So I know this is one of Chris's big problems with this particular way of looking at things, is it leaves quantum operations in a terrible mess in terms of, you know, if you wanted to know, is this quantum operation objective or subjective? Well, currently, you'd have to come to me, and I'd have to look at it, and every one of them I'd have to look at as a separate case to tell you whether it was objective or subjective, except for these big classes that I just mentioned to you. And then I think a big problem with this, relative to fundamental physics, is the attributes we assign to most systems that we currently deal with are really effective attributes that arise out of more fundamental, at least a physicist's idea of what's more fundamental theories, and that's certainly true of Hamiltonians. There's really no Hamiltonian, let's say, at the atomic physics level or even at the nuclear level that's a fundamental Hamiltonian. And deriving those, guess what, always involves quantum states. It's not something that's just follows from the Hamiltonian of the underlying stuff. And so then I'm left in a pretty big mess in terms of what I mean by saying a Hamiltonian subjective. Anyway, I'll leave you with those questions, and thanks for listening.
Okay, we're pretty much out of time. I might just take one or two questions while Chris is setting up. Howard.
So back to the first part of your talk. The list you gave is undeniable in its argument.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that.
Sorry?
I'm glad to hear you say that.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Describing what it is, because it's neither something like a probability distribution nor like a configuration.
I guess it's also true that we're a little uncomfortable with these words objective and subjective, because if you pressed us about the facts that we gather from the world, we like to think of as having more to do with the world than the agent. But if you pressed us, we'd actually say those were facts for the agent. Otherwise, we run into some real problems down the road in our interpretation. So it may be that we need some other words, which really would mean just defining things more carefully. My personal view is that what we mean by objective probably needs to be fixed. But I'm happy with subjective. Things that are not properties of the world, but properties of us. I think we've got that down. Now, in your list, you might reach a different conclusion, but that part I'm very comfortable with now. Mainly because, the Copenhagen deal, that was all Chris, not browbeating Rüdiger and I, but convincing us of a thing that, puts us out in the idea that preparation devices don't reliably prepare quantum states. Where does that put us? That puts us so far in left field, that's a baseball term, so far into left field that, it's only at a conference like this that anybody would even listen to us. So I'm grateful for the opportunity to talk here, but it really is way out there. And Rüdiger and I resisted that for a long time, and to Chris's credit, he convinced us that, you just can't get away with the Copenhagen way of thinking.
It was browbeating.
Yeah, but it was better than browbeating.
It happened in Australia.
Do I need to finish?
I'm in charge here.
You are, indeed.
But we really are out of time now.
Yep.
But to remind people, there will be coffee and refreshments served afterwards, so there'll be an opportunity after Chris's talk for further discussion outside. But now let's thank Carl for questions. While Chris is setting up, I just wanted to show you, and especially since Carl was showing us his travel photos during that talk, I just wanted to show you one of mine, which I actually found this morning when I was looking through a box of old transparencies, trying to find some blank ones to put in Chris's talk. It seemed especially relevant because we've now had at least two talks in which the issue of the sort of hour of time, hour of thermodynamics was particularly to the fore. And of course, one of the great heroes of all of that discussion is Loschmidt, a colleague of Boltzmann's, author of the famous Loschmidt reversibility objection. And Loschmidt, like Boltzmann, was both at the University of Vienna, where they now have a courtyard where the greats like Loschmidt and Boltzmann and Mark and Schrödinger and so on are all immortalized in memorials around this courtyard. And this is a picture of Loschmidt's memorial. And as you see, there's a wonderful way in which they've captured the essence of Loschmidt's reversibility objection in the signage. Let me get this the right way up. Is that good enough? I don't know if you can see the sign on the right here says Ausgang and pointing to the exit like the one. Hold on. Okay. I'm delighted, particularly delighted to welcome our last speaker, Chris Root from the Primitive Institute, who's going to be speaking to us on the topic of what I want from this collaboration. Welcome, Chris.
Well, thank you. Carl Cave said that I'm an evangelist. I'm not so much of an evangelist, or at least not a very successful one. But I am usually a person with an agenda. And today, the agenda is I want to show you one, what I think is a pretty little equation. And that'll come at the very end of the talk. It's just one equation. That's what we're shooting for. But along the way, I'd like you to have a little fun, as long as you don't slow me down too much. So just keep that in mind. So Hugh was right. What I want from this collaboration, it's kind of a funny thing that I would even give a talk a title like that at a Quantum Foundations conference, because some number of years ago, I wrote a paper that started off this way. I said, in this paper, I try to cause some good-natured trouble. The issue at stake is, when will we ever stop burdening the taxpayer with conferences and workshops devoted explicitly or implicitly to quantum foundations? Well, 6 years have passed, and I'm still finding myself attracted to quantum foundational issues. And 6 years later, I'm still using some of the same transparencies that I developed for that talk. This is one of them, many of you have seen. And this is another one, an overlay that goes over it. And I carefully drew them on two different sheets of plastic for a reason. I wanted to emphasize something then, and I want to emphasize it now, that the point of view we're playing with is a point of view that there are quantum states, and they're one thing, and there are quantum systems, and they're another thing. And the reason these are on two pieces of plastic is because I'd like to disconvince you of the idea that this thing is physically attached to that thing. They're separate entities. The language that Rob Speckens likes to use is that one lives in the category of the ontic, and the other one lives in the category of the epistemic. In the language that Carl Caves used, one lives in the category of the objective, and the other lives in the category of the subjective. Now, why would we want to make this distinction? Well, along the theme that quantum foundations is just good physics, which is what we need to convince the rest of the physics world, we think that by making this distinction between these two things, we can address some issues, particularly issues in quantum information, things that we might think are outstanding, shocking features of quantum mechanics, and say, well, if you take the point of view that quantum states are epistemic or subjective, then that shocking feature of quantum information is rather normal or regular. A good example came up in Rob's talk that I like, and I'll give you my own take on it, the concept of teleportation. I'm just going to put belief teleportation up there to tantalize you if I can for the moment. Rob's was within the context of his toy model, but we all know what teleportation is. Alice and Bob share an entangled, maximally entangled quantum state. There's somebody, Victor the Verifier, who walks up to Alice with a quantum state, gives it to her. She doesn't know what he's given. And she performs some measurement on the two qubits in front of her. Then she gets on the telephone. She sends two bits of classical information to Bob. Bob performs one of four operations. So in other words, he uses those two classical bits up that she gave him. And at the end of the process, Victor the Verifier says, aha, that quantum system over there is in the same quantum state that my original system was. So we have this idea that actually that's not such a mysterious thing. And the founders of quantum teleportation probably shouldn't have advertised it so vigorously. Because if you take the point of view that quantum states are epistemic, there's a certain sense in which it's rather natural. So I dug up three coins. I thought I'd try to make a point. So I'm going to give Tibor two of them and ask you to put them either both heads up or both heads down. You can look at them.
Okay.
Both heads up or both heads down. And then give Hugh Price one of them and give Steve Bartlett the
do I give to them in the same state? I have to maintain...
They're both heads up or they're both heads down.
But I have to maintain the orientation.
You do.
Right.
And they do too.
Right, okay. Are we allowed to look at them?
Yeah, you can look at them. It'll be okay with me if you look at them, I think. I mean, it messes up the analogy a little bit, but that'll be fine. Okay, so you gave them the same orientation. You're not going to tell us what it is, and you're not going to tell us what it is, and you're not going to tell us what it is. And I'll ask Rob Speckens, do you think he has a head or a tail? Steve, you think it's 50-50 chance he has a head or a tail? Now, I kept this one coin out because it's kind of screwed up on the edges, and it doesn't look to me like it's completely fair, so I flip it. And because it's not fair, I'm not going to give a probability of 50-50 to heads. Actually, I have a different estimate for it. Let's call it X. And in my head, X has a value, but I'm not going to reveal it to you. Okay, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give this coin to Tibor. He has to keep the same orientation of it. I don't know what it is myself. I haven't looked at it. It could be heads or could be tails. I've got a probability assignment that I've given it. Let's call it X. Probability X that it's heads. Okay. I'm going to give it to Tibor. He's going to carefully hand it to Hugh. And you're going to preserve the orientation, won't you? Because you're a good friend of mine.
Okay. Do you want to look at it or does it not?
No, you don't look at it.
Okay. All right. Okay. So I have to give it to you. Hugh will have to look at it.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'll have to look at it. You'll have to look at it eventually. Go ahead and look at it now. Okay. I want you to note whether the two coins have the same value or just the different values. Okay? You have noted that. Now, will you say it out loud, whether they're the same or whether they're different?
They're different.
They're different. Okay. So, Steve, will you turn yours over? He did. Okay. Rob, what's your probability assignment for a head on that one? I'm sorry, I revealed X to you. I shouldn't have. If you didn't know X, what would be your probability assignment for heads?
50.
It would be 50-50, right? But what do I know? I had a probability assignment of X for my coin. I gave it to Hugh. Hugh looked at it and said, they're different. So that means he flipped his over. And if we just follow the logic through, well, what do I write down for his coin? I now say the probability of it being a head is X.
So Steve, is it X?
Not very interesting, really. But this is the process of teleportation from the point of view of taking quantum states. You guys can keep those coins. I didn't give you dollars. So it seems to clarify some things, but at the same time, a lot of people, particularly in foundations, would say that it muddies other things, this point of view that quantum states are epistemic or subjective. For instance, there was a hidden variable in that picture, and some of us really aren't attracted to the ideas of hidden variables. But I think this is good for demonstrating a point that I want to make over and over in this talk, that it could just be, and I think this is what we're identifying, that some of the features of quantum states and quantum information just track the idea of probabilities. That idea of probability doesn't change in going from the classical world to the quantum world. But instead, something else happens when we go from the classical to the quantum. And here's the way I want to emphasize it. It's not the idea of probability that changes, but rather what the probabilities are about that changes. And this is my own particular point of view on this, that the probabilities, once we get to the quantum mechanical case, they're still probabilities in the good old Bayesian sense, but they're not probabilities about the pre-existing states of reality. They're probabilities about something else. And for want of a better word at the moment, I'll say the consequences of measurement interactions, and I'll put measurements in in quotes. So if I make this point that the probabilities, there are probabilities there, and the probabilities, you know, I'm going to, after listening to Carl's talk, you know, I'm going to take the point of view that probabilities are subjective, and the probabilities are about something that has the word measurement in it, which means it refers to me, this agent that Carl kept talking about. Haven't I given up on reality altogether? Both things here refer to me. These are my, this is my judgment, my degrees of belief. These are the sensations that I, the observer, pick up. Why bother with this idea of reality? Well, I think there's about no clearer statement than this one by Martin Gardner. The hypothesis that there is an external world not dependent on human minds, made of something, is so obviously useful and so strongly confirmed by experience down through the ages that we can say without exaggerating that it is better confirmed than any other empirical hypothesis. Well, I like that so much because I agree with it. What's going on in quantum mechanics? I think we've learned perhaps a great lesson from quantum mechanics, and I have tried to write it poetically. I think it's this. It's just a deep idea, but it comes out of a very particular field of human experience, quantum mechanics. Every physical experiment is a transaction with nature. So there's this thing called nature, and you're the experimenter, or you're the measurer, you're the observer, you're the agent. And in order to do those things that you're doing, you have to reach out and touch nature. You have to reach out and touch the stuff. And what we are discovering in quantum mechanics is that nature is not so passive as to just feed me sensations without letting me feed it sensations in some sense or other. In other words, it's simply that the classical worldview of an observer there being affected by the world but not affecting it back in the process is a little too one-sided. So this has caused me to draw this kind of picture for the, at least the way I conceive of quantum measurement. By the way, you will see equations. You will. Not yet.
Quick question.
It better be quick.
Will you later talk about how your perception that physical experiments and transactions in nature relates to something like quantum bomb detection or something?
No, I won't talk about that. No, I'm shooting for one equation. It's John Wheeler told this story about a great cactus in the desert that lives for, God, Carl Caves could tell us, so many years. It gets absolutely huge, and then at the near the end of its life, it finally blooms one little flower, and the whole purpose of the growth for all those years was just to make the one little flower. Okay. Here's the way I conceive of quantum measurement. There is this thing, this entity. It's the subject matter of the theory. It's the agent. And there, instead of just having a big eyeball looking at things, in place of his hands are these measurement devices. There's an external world, too. There's quantum systems out there. And from time to time, the agent takes a good, swift kick to the world. That's called measurement. He kicks the world, and it kicks him back. He gets an outcome to his quantum measurement. That's a positive operator value measure here. And if you were to ask, well, isn't all of this solipsism like I have been accused of? I would say, no, with every quantum measurement, we get good evidence that there's an external world. We kick the world, and it kicks us back in some unexpected way. So the point of view here is that a measurement isn't just a passive intake of information, but rather that the agent has an interaction with the system. The system acts as a kind of catalyst in some sense, hopefully ultimately to be made precise, that leads to a sensation on the part of the agent. Now, this is an idea that is has some representation in some fields of philosophy, particularly American pragmatism, which I was lucky enough to run into. And then I don't know if this exactly tracks Hugh Price's philosophy of, of language, but you can see elements in here that are somewhat like this. So here's Hughes' description of his philosophy of language project, I believe, as a whole. And let me just read it. Very crudely put, the explanatory project goes something like this. We find our speakers, our language users, that's his concern. We find our speakers disposed to say P, i.e., P appears in the list of statements on the left of the model. He had given some imagery earlier in the paper. We now ask, why do they say that? Why do they say P? And in general, without pretending that this distinction is sharp, we look for an explanation that refers both to the features of the speakers and to features of their natural environment. Note that in our own case, this attitude always looks sideways on or ironic. We say that P and then wonder why we said so. How we come to be making a claim of that kind, looking for something deeper as an answer, of course, than merely being because we realized that P. This is the kind of irony characteristic of practitioners of the human sciences, of course, who cannot help but view themselves as examples of their own objects of inquiry. The point of view that I was just showing you about quantum measurement, I think, takes the idea very seriously that our usage of quantum states, the probability assignments we make in quantum mechanics, is a very particular species of this thing that Hugh is talking about, the use of language. And so I co-opted his paragraph and I changed it to my purposes to try to capture what I was just telling you. Very crudely put, the explanatory project goes something like this. In other words, this is the Quantum Foundation's program being outlined here. The explanatory project goes something like this. We find our agents disposed to accept the structural features of quantum mechanics into their catalog of probability assignments. We now ask, why do they say that? Why do they make those probability assignments? And in general, without pretending that this distinction is sharp, we look for an explanation that refers both to the features of the speakers and features of their natural environment. Another way to put the same idea is one that I stole from a long-dead pragmatist as opposed to the very alive Hugh Price. A quantum state is not a mirror in which a reality external to us is faithfully reflected. It is simply a biological function. A quantum state is a biological function, a means of orientation in life, of preserving and enriching it, of enabling and facilitating action, of taking account of reality and dominating it. We write down quantum states because we want to do something with the nature that surrounds us. Okay. That's the introduction. What I'd like to do now is stop the cartoons, for the most part, and get down to the hard work of trying to see whether some of these English statements can be found within the mathematical structure of quantum mechanics. And for this now, I'll focus on quantum mechanics. Here's the point of view. The main object that's of our concern are density operators, the space of quantum states. And we know that these density operators, their mathematical structure, is that they're a convex set living in the space of linear operators on some complex vector space, and in my case, it's going to be a finite dimension D. The sorts of questions that I need to ask are, why this structure? If I'm going to take it seriously that these things, quantum states, are catalogs of our uncertainty, that they're Bayesian probabilities or catalogs of Bayesian probabilities, well, then why do they obtain this structure that I've drawn here? Why not some other structure? Is it simply fortuitous that it was this structure, and with hindsight we came along and gave this interpretation to quantum states, this interpretation down here? Or rather, might we motivate the whole structure by taking this point of view seriously from the outset? I'm going to tackle a little corner of that question. Particularly, I'd like to know something about this. Given a quantum state rho and an observable, some Hermitian operator, if we imagine performing a measurement of the system, corresponding to that operator. If we want to calculate the probabilities of the outcomes of such a measurement, we know what we should do is take the Hermitian operator, diagonalize it, get an eigendecomposition, find the eigenprojectors, and then we calculate the probabilities of the outcomes according to what is standardly called the Born rule for calculating probabilities. What I'd like in the end to know is why this rule and not some other. We had the structure of Hilbert space, but it's not obvious that this is the one and only sort of thing that one can do to calculate probabilities. And more particularly, what I'd really like to get at in this lecture is just how do I understand this rule? Maybe I won't really give a reason for it, but I think I can give a way of understanding it that is somewhat different, radically different, maybe, than the usual way of understanding it. So that's going to be the goal. Trying to give some way of understanding this rule. Well, you might say, well, here's an easy way to understand it. There's this thing called the quantum state, rho, and you use it to calculate probabilities. And this is just the rule that takes rho and calculates probabilities. Well, I don't want to think of it that way. I don't want to think that there's this separate entity called rho. There's this objective feature of a quantum system called rho, for which you use a certain rule to extract probabilities. I want to do something else. Now, in the literature, there are a couple of ways of taking the point of view that quantum states are catalogs of uncertainties seriously, so going back to this. And I shouldn't fool you. There are distinct ways of trying to take this idea seriously. One of them is to think of quantum probabilities, or quantum, sometimes called quantum probability theory, as a larger structure that's larger than classical probability theory. And classical probability theory is just a special case of this bigger mathematical structure called quantum probability, the case where all the density operators involved in one's considerations commute with each other. Well, that's one point of view. Then there's another point of view of a class of people that I'm going to call the quantum Bayesians. And I tell you, I've been working hard to get people into this list so at least it looks more impressive. But at the moment, the only ones I really feel comfortable with calling by this name, and maybe even one of them, if he were here, he'd kick me, Matt Liefer. But there's a group of these guys. I mean, this guy is neither pro nor contra, but he did write a review. So if you're interested in more details on this sort of thing, I think you can look up this paper on the Philosophy of Science Archive by Chris Timpson. For these guys, this idea that classical probability theory is just a special case of something larger, something determined by the particular properties of the world, quantum probability theory, is a category error. For it would imply that mathematical logic or probability logic was either a special case of physics, or it would imply that physics is a special case of mathematical logic. Well, that would be a funny position to be in, I think. You say, well, we didn't know about quantum mechanics in 1850, and we didn't know about classical mechanics in 1595. But what did we do? We used, presumably we did experiments. Galileo is a good example of someone who did experiments. And he used some logical operations to look at his data and finally come up with a theory. If the logical operations he used were dependent upon the particular properties of the physical world, it seems that one would be stuck in a rather uncomfortable position. How would you discover a new theory if your logic depended upon the other theory that you don't know yet? So we don't take that point of view. Instead, we take something more along the lines of this that Bernard and Smith wrote when they said, "What is the nature and scope of Bayesian statistics?" Bayesian statistics offers a rationalist theory of personalistic beliefs in context of uncertainty, with the central aim of characterizing how an individual should act in order to avoid certain kinds of undesirable behavioral inconsistencies. The theory establishes so forth, so on. Then it finally says, the goal, in effect, is to establish rules and procedures for individuals concerned with disciplined uncertainty accounting. Disciplined uncertainty accounting, whatever the source of the uncertainty, The theory is not descriptive in the sense of claiming to model actual behavior. This is important. Rather, it is prescriptive in the sense of saying, if you wish to avoid the possibility of these undesirable consequences, you must act in the following way. So this puts probability firmly on the side of a kind of behavioral science or a kind of Darwinian science. If you want to survive, you use all the tools available to you to help you in your survival. And one tool available to you is probability theory. So there it is, probability theory. It's kind of a foundation on which we're going to build lots of things in our swimming through the sea of life. One thing that we might use probability theory for is the subject of economics. We want to make money. We don't want to lose money. Well, when we do that, what do? We take this base called probability theory, and then we particularize it to the subject matter at hand, which might be the financial markets. There's probability theory, and then we add some extra structure to probability theory that says it's reasonable to assume this or that connection between your various probability assignments. That's one way that probability theory might be used. Another way that probability theory might be used is to particularize the subject to the physical world. Here, you'd say, oh, my concern is to better understand what will happen to my fingers when I hit this if I have first grounded myself on something. So in other words, the subject matter is now the physical world and your interactions with the physical world, and you particularize your use of probability theory to that. If you're looking for some evidence of some ontology, like Carl was in his talk, what does this tell you? It tells you not to look in the particular assignments that are being made in probability theory, but rather in the structural features that you're using for narrowing down your probability assignments. So let me give you a little bit of a history of what I mean by this idea, or Bernardo's idea, that probability is a normative theory or a prescriptive theory, I think he said. You should use the laws of probability if you want to avoid certain nasty consequences. And the Bayesian take on probability theory, one can trace that back all the way to the definition of what probability means in the first place. So I'm going to define probability, and I'm going to try to define it somewhat carefully. So instead of defining probability on one transparency, I think I'm going to take about five. Here's the Bayesian idea of probability. In its simplest form, it goes to something called a Dutch book. Here's the very definition of probability for a Bayesian, or a Bayesian of this class, or this variety. When the bookie up here declares a probability P of E, you see he's got them all posted on the wall outside of his window. Declaring P of E means that he will buy or sell a lottery ticket, a particular lottery ticket, that's worth $1 if an event E obtains. And he'll buy or sell that lottery ticket at your request for this price, P of E. So when he publishes a probability, this is what he means by it. He'll buy or sell these tickets, and maybe he'll pocket a little extra cash so that he's not doing this for free. But he'll trade these tickets worth $1 if the event E obtains for this value. That's the definition of probability from this point of view. Now, here's something kind of funny. The history of the frequency interpretation of probability is usually motivated by the idea that we want probabilities to be something objective and measurable. And you go out and you look at frequencies and they tell you probabilities. Now, a difficulty with that is in any finite run of something, you might find frequencies. Those frequencies may be very different from the probability that you'll ultimately estimate. So part of the criticism of probability is, of the frequency interpretation, is that in the end, you haven't really invented a measurable notion of probability. The Bayesian tries to sidestep that by making probability measurable at the outset. If you're wondering what someone's probability assignment is for some event, you offer him a bet and you see if he accepts it. It's not a precise experiment, but it does extract, ultimately, the value. So this is the definition of probability. It looks awfully weak. You would think, how on earth can you ever get the structure of probability theory out of this kind of idea? And you're right, you can't get it just straight out of the definition. To this definition, you have to add a normative principle like Bernardo and Smith were talking about. And this is usually called Dutch book coherence, Dutch book consistency. Here's the rule. You should never declare a probability for any event, P of E or P of not E or P of E or F. You should never declare a probability that will lead you to a sure loss. So when you declare these probabilities, it means you're willing to buy and sell lottery tickets appropriately for them. You should never make assignments that would lead you to a sure loss. Surprisingly, this little idea here gives the whole structure of probability theory. Let me give you an example. Suppose a bookie declares P sub E that's less than zero. That means the bookie will buy or sell tickets for a negative amount of money. In particular, he'll sell a ticket for a negative amount of money. If he sells a ticket for a negative amount of money, then regardless of what event pertains, he will have lost money. So he shouldn't have probabilities that are less than zero. Alternatively, consider another example. Suppose the bookie sets his probability larger than one. It means he'll buy or sell a ticket for more than $1. And in particular, he will buy a ticket for more than it's actually worth. So even if in the best case scenario, when E obtains, he'll get $1, but he has spent more than $1 in purchasing the ticket. So probabilities have to be between 0 and 1 just from this normative principle. Let me go to a better case, or a little more complicated of a case. Suppose we have two events, E and F, that are mutually exclusive. So E and F are mutually exclusive, and let's consider three possible lottery tickets that one can make for this situation. One lottery ticket's worth $1 if either E or F obtains. Another lottery ticket is worth $1 if E obtains. Another one is worth $1 if F obtains. Okay? Just notice the following. If you were to buy these two tickets, that's equivalent to buying this one ticket. So whatever you would be willing to pay for this ticket and this ticket, it should add up to what you would pay for this ticket. Otherwise, someone can run a Dutch book against you. They can cause you to have a sure loss. So it has to be the case that what you'd pay for this ticket, which is by definition P of E or F, has to equal to the sum of the other two probabilities. So you've gotten the additive rule of probability. Another little thing just to notice, because I'm going to use it on the next transparency, is if we were now talking about tickets not just worth a dollar, but worth some rational amount of dollars, dollar M over N, if E, how much would this ticket be worth? Well, you can just do it as a homework problem. You can say, well, if M were 1, then N of these tickets should be worth the original ticket up here. So, of course, this thing would be worth M over N times P of E. So if it doesn't pay $1, you pay the appropriate, the price should include the appropriate fraction. So this really simple idea starts to give rise to the structure of probability. Let me show you the most interesting case. How do you get Bayes' rule from this kind of consideration? Well, you do that by considering conditional lotteries. Conditional lotteries. So here's what I mean by this. So remember, here, let me write down what Bayes' rule is for you so you just remember. It's that the probability of E and F is equal to the probability of F times the probability of F, probability of E given F. This is Bayes' rule. How would you get this out of a Dutch book kind of argument? Well, to do that, we consider conditional lotteries. Here's how they go. If we're going to consider lotteries of this structure here. If E and F are true, both true, we will give the full price for the lottery, whatever the ticket's worth. But if F actually does not obtain, but instead not F obtains, then any money that you've given will be returned to you. So that means there are lottery tickets of this structure. It's worth $1 if E and F. It's worth some amount, the amount you paid, the price of it, if F doesn't obtain. But consider two other lotteries that are natural, or that would be around, just because we're considering these events. One ticket says it's worth $1 if E and F. Well, by definition, we would pay this price for it. Here's another lottery. It's worth this amount, particularly, if F doesn't obtain. So in other words, this is the same ticket as worth $1 if not F, but we've rescaled it. Well, then the price that we should pay for it is the amount that we would have paid for the $1 ticket times that. Okay, so we've got one kind of ticket, and we've got two kinds of others, and the same story as we used before holds, namely that if I were to buy these two tickets, it's the same thing as buying this one ticket. Just look at the logical structure of it. If F doesn't obtain, then this one was worth this much, but if F doesn't obtain, this one was worth this much. If F obtains and D obtains, then this of these two, this one was worth something, this is worth zero, and this is worth the $1 too. So buying these two is equivalent to buying that one, and that tells you that you had better pay the same price for the two options. Namely, up here you would have paid this much, and down here you would have paid this much plus that much, and you do a little bit of algebra on that and you get Bayes' rule. So there is the, for the most part, the structure of probability theory. And it comes from this simple normative principle. From it, we can derive other things that we often use in probability theory. Let's say, for instance, the law of total probability. And now I'm going to start changing notation a little bit. So H represents the kind of event I'm talking about, D does too, and I'm just using P's for everything. So if I have some prior probabilities for a hypothesis H, and I have some conditional probabilities for some data given the hypothesis, I know that I can take those two degrees of belief, or those two structures, and put them together to get an estimate for how I should gamble when I'm talking about the event D. This is used all over the place in all textbook examples. And it's this, actually, that's going to have something to do with the Born rule. That's what I'll tell you about. So just remember the origin of it here. The origin of this comes from Dutch book coherence. It's not wanting to lose money in a sure fashion. So how can I relate any of these thoughts to quantum mechanics? Well, for that I have to develop a story that many of you have seen now over and over and over. But three of you haven't, so I'll show it again. So here's the idea. I want to find some mapping from quantum states to probability distributions, and I want to do that so that I have a direct way of comparing the two calculuses, probability theory and the calculus of quantum states. My favored way of doing that is to introduce a very special measurement that I put up in the Bureau of Standards with the standard kilogram and the standard meter stick, and I call it the standard quantum measurement. And the idea behind this measurement is there is some measurement up here such that if I were to take a quantum system from the external world, take it up to this Bureau of Standards and drop it in, the outcomes that I get from this measurement, the probabilities for the outcomes, uniquely determine the quantum state back here. I want to find some measurement device that will do that for me. And if I can find such a measurement device, then I can get rid of this idea of a quantum state and just substitute the probability distribution for the outcomes of my measurement up there. So in place of quantum states, I want to now use probability distributions. And it may seem like a roundabout thing to do, but once I have found a mapping that takes me from quantum states to probability distributions, I'd like to see what quantum mechanics looks like purely in terms of those probability distributions. So, for instance, if I were considering a completely different measurement, not this one up here, but something down here, this one has three outcomes, this one has four outcomes, so some other measurement, I'd like to be able to calculate the probabilities for this kind of measurement device out here. Now, the usual story would say, well, you use the quantum state, and you calculate it over here by using the Born rule. I want to do something more complicated. At least it looks like that at first. I would like to just transform this guy directly into this guy. I'd like to take my probabilities for the outcomes of what would happen up in the Bureau of Standards and turn that into probabilities for what's going to happen out here in the world. And if I were to consider a different measurement, a completely different one, similarly, I'd like to do the same game. If there's another measurement device out here with two possible outcomes, I'd like to calculate these probabilities directly from those probabilities and look at what the structure of that looks like. So what can I use up here in the Bureau of Standards so that I get this effect that I would like? Well, you can immediately see that you can't use a regular von Neumann measurement. The reason for that is, if you're talking about a von Neumann measurement, some Hermitian operator with eigenprojectors, and you look at the probabilities of the outcomes of such a measurement, it tells you something about the diagonal on the density operator, but it doesn't tell you anything about the off-diagonal. So you have to use not von Neumann measurements, but generalized measurements, or positive operator-valued measures. And I think in this audience, I don't have to explain this, so therefore I'm not. Just simply take it that there's this generalized notion of measurement, and the way we represent a measurement is to give a list of operators. And the list of operators represent the different outcomes for the measurement. We've dropped the idea that the operators have to be orthogonal to each other. They simply have to be positive semi-definite, sum to the identity, and we calculate probabilities by the Born rule. How much time do I have you?
We've got about another 15, perhaps 30 minutes of answer.
Excellent. Good. You know, at some point I'll slow down and the two or three hands that have been going up, I'll pay you attention. Well, what's good about POVMs is that they give me the power to do what I want to do. Why do they do that? Well, there's no restriction on the number of outcomes in a POVM. Quantum states are elements of the linear vector space of operators on the Hilbert space. So that means if the Hilbert space is of dimension D, then these density operators live in a D squared dimensional vector space. If I can choose a POVM for which all of the elements are linearly independent, and I have enough elements to span the whole space, so if these operators are linearly independent in this vector space, and I have enough to span the whole space, then I can just notice the following, that the probabilities of the outcomes for that measurement, for such a measurement, are given by the Born rule, but the Born rule is just the inner product, the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product between the quantum state rho and this other operator, E sub h. This is an inner product. So what the Born rule represents is the projection of one vector onto another vector in that vector space. And we know that if we have a basis that spans the space, then knowing the projections of a vector onto all of the elements in the basis, from that I can reconstruct the vector that I'm interested in. So if I have any such measurement that satisfies the properties that I just talked about up here, that can be my standard quantum measurement for the Bureau of Standards. Well, they do exist. And because they exist, they give me the representation that I wanted. Instead of thinking of quantum states as elements of this complex vector space, I now have a mapping. Once I have chosen one particular measurement for the Bureau of Standards, I now have a mapping that puts quantum states onto a simplex. They now become probability distributions. Now, here's something kind of funny about this business. These measurements do exist, so you can use them, and they give you a mapping from quantum states to probability distributions, and they give you a one-to-one mapping. That's what I hope I've demonstrated to you, but they don't give you an onto mapping. There are points on the simplex outside of some convex region, let's say a point out here, that doesn't correspond to a valid quantum state via this mapping. So the valid quantum states live on the inside of some kind of convex region, and the other points on the simplex simply don't correspond to quantum states. What does the shape of this region look like? Well, it turns out that the shape of the region is intimately connected to which measurement device I've chosen for the Bureau of Standards. Some measurement devices that would work for the Bureau of Standards make a rather asymmetric shape up there, and some of them make a rather symmetric shape. What I'd like to do is develop some criterion for what would be a good shape here, what would make posing quantum mechanics in these terms the prettiest, and because it's the prettiest, the one that is the most, pregnant with possibility for exploring quantum mechanics from this point of view. So to develop a criterion, let me go backwards. Let me look at this map more carefully, the one that takes me from quantum states to probability distributions. I'm going to take the path back to density operators. So suppose I have a measurement that has the right number of outcomes and is informationally complete. That means I can use it for the Bureau of Standards. Then the probabilities of the outcome of that measurement completely determine rho. But also, because this is a basis for the vector space, I can write rho as linear combinations of these basis vectors. Well, what do these basis vectors look like in terms of these probabilities? That's the question that's on my mind. Well, you can see how they're connected just simply by writing this expression out. P of j is equal to trace rho of E of j. But rho, we know, is determined by this expansion, so we just plug it in. And now we write that equation, that set of equations, in vector notation. So we have a vector P that is given by a linear transformation on some vector alpha, where the elements of the linear transformation is the trace of the products of these POVM elements. So that means we can find the alphas in terms of the P's. You just invert the matrix and multiply it across. So the question I'd like to know is, when is this the prettiest sort of thing? Well, it's prettiest if you can take M to be a diagonal matrix. But it turns out you can't take it to be a diagonal matrix. The closest you can come is a matrix that has a constant down the diagonal and then a non-zero constant everywhere else. So you can do this. And I had a transparency constructing how you can always do this. But I think I'm going to skip that so we can get back to conceptual issues and just tell you about one famous case that looks like it will do it. Now, so you can construct things that have that very simple structure. But then there's this case of a measurement that Carl Caves started asking whether it existed in 1999, and no one really knows yet. But it makes things awfully pretty. And there's a lot of evidence now that it does exist. Several papers, and it's known at least numerically to exist up to dimension 47 because of work that Robin Blum-Cahout has done. So suppose you have D squared projectors that satisfy this very nice symmetry condition, that if you take the inner product of any two of them, it's equal to a particular constant. Well, just from these properties, you can show that these projection operators have to be linearly independent, and you can show that if you renormalize them by a constant factor, they sum up to the identity. So they make a perfect example of a measurement that would be good for the Bureau of Standards. And moreover, they have the nice property that I told you about a minute ago. So if you calculate the probabilities of the outcome of such a measurement and invert and find a quantum state rho, then you can write rho as a linear combination of the pi I and the expansion coefficients, or the whatever they're called, are just given by the things between my fingers that are easily related to the probabilities. Just so happens. Okay, this was the one tool that we really needed. So if there's, how much time do I have now?
7 minutes.
I'll take a couple of short questions if there are any questions now that haven't been run over with a steam train.
Is this the equation you need?
No. Okay. But it's close. It's close. So what does this give us? Well, already from this, it gives us a little tool for thinking about the Born rule in a different way. And here's the way. take the quantum state, rho, this thing that we usually imagine is prior to the probabilities. We calculate probabilities from it. Take some other measurement, not the standard measurement, not the one that we're using, and calculate the probabilities for the outcomes of that measurement. Well, we're just going to plug in the little expansion that we had from the previous page, and you get the following, that the probabilities for the outcomes of this new measurement are determined from the probabilities of the outcomes of the Bureau of Standards, and then there are some transformation coefficients that transform you from one measurement to another. Well, from our Bayesian, for what we're wanting out of a Bayesian view of quantum mechanics, this now fits the bill of the sort of thing that we wanted. In this picture, there is no extra thing called the quantum state. There's only the probabilities for the outcomes of a Bureau of Standards. And that, from our point of view, is a judgment. I have a system here, and it's me who actually has accepted quantum mechanics. What I mean by that is I've accepted a little region in probability theory space that says I'm going to relate my probabilities in certain ways. If I've accepted quantum mechanics, then I'll choose a valid probability, but that's still my judgment. And now if I want to know what I should believe about the outcomes of some other measurement, I can get from here these probabilities to these probabilities by some simple kind of transformation rule. So the role of the Born rule isn't to set probabilities from something else, but rather it's a transformation rule from this point of view. But now let's consider something else. You can go a little further than this. Look at this. You can ask, well, we talked about Dutch book consistency, and Dutch book consistency told us how to relate probabilities. Let's look at what this sort of thing gives us. Suppose we take the terms that we just had in here, trace of pi I. So pi I are the projectors onto the outcomes at the Bureau of Standards, and these EHs are POVMs for some other measurement. Suppose I write those as a conditional probability. Conditional probability of outcome J for the second measurement given outcome I in the Bureau of Standards. And just plug that into the previous formula. Here, in particular, I'm going to assume that EJ corresponds to any von Neumann measurement, just so things get really clean. So any von Neumann measurement consisting of rank 1 operators, that's the setting here. Well, if you plug it in to the previous formula, then what do you get? You get that the probability of the E measurement, the probabilities of the outcomes of the E measurement, are determined by two things. The probabilities of the outcomes of the Bureau of Standards measurement, and the conditional probabilities of the outcomes of the E measurement given the Bureau of Standards measurement. And the formula is just this. It looks a lot like the law of total probability that we got just out of regular Bayesian reasoning, except it's got these two little extra terms, one that's covered by that finger and one that's covered by that finger. Now, this strikes me as very odd. See, the law of total probability was based on the idea that, let's say I have firm beliefs for something that has outcomes I. And I have, I can dig into my head and find my beliefs for the outcomes J of something else if I already recognize the outcome I of the first thing. And Dutch book coherence tells me how to put those two things together to make an estimate for my probabilities of J to begin with. Now, in the quantum case, so we say, suppose I'm considering some measurement that I can perform here, and I ask myself, do I have firm degrees of belief about what will happen here? And I might tell myself, no, I don't. All I really have are firm degrees of belief about what would happen up at the Bureau of Standards, and I have firm degrees of belief of, if I had just performed a Bureau of Standards measurement, what I would find out here at this other measurement device. Those two things I have. A priori, there's no reason, it seems to me, that quantum mechanics would say, oh, there's some calculus for combining those two things and giving rise to the actual quantum probability. But it turns out that there is a calculus for it. I take the old thing that I would have done classically, and then I just kind of stretch the distribution a little bit. And what I mean by stretch the distribution is, if you think of a probability distribution, this extra little operation multiplying by d plus 1 and subtracting 1 is like pulling the distribution up and having it draw in. In other words, I end up with a little more certainty than I would have if I had reasoned purely classically. Well, I think this gives us a handle, and I think I'll close the lecture pretty soon by saying I think this gives us a new handle for exploring an old issue that's usually, at least in my mind, best captured by the considerations that go into Bell inequality violations and the Cochin-Specker theorem, and that is, does a measurement reveal a pre-existing but unknown value, or does measurement in some sense go toward creating the very value? When I kick the podium and it kicks me back, does that bring something new into the world, or is it something that was predetermined? And we usually handle that kind of question with this issue of Cochin-Specker, which I won't talk about. But I think what has been uncovered here is that in Dutch book consistency arguments, ultimately what must be happening is that a hidden assumption of the reality of the first proposition is being used, being leaned on very heavily. And that's the whole idea behind the conditional betting scenarios. You're saying, if this happens or doesn't happen, what will happen? I mean, what kind of return will I get on my bet? In quantum mechanics, if you don't go up and perform the measurement in the Bureau of Standards, what quantum mechanics does is it takes the probability rule that you would have, I mean, the probability assignment that you would have made if those two things actually had happened, and gives you a little reward for not actually performing the measurement. And I think that must be an expression of Cochin-Specker again, but in a completely different guise. So here was the whole point of the lecture. It was to show you this equation and to show you how it fits into the program that Carl and Rudiger Schock and Marcus Appleby and I have been leaning on for a few years now. And hopefully to give you some sense of what I really would like out of this collaboration. I view all of this and all of this, these sets of considerations as having something to do with quantum mechanics and having something to do with this more general philosophy that Hugh Price was talking about that's called, has a name, it's called pragmatism. And what I'd like out of this collaboration is a chance to discuss the union of these two things, and I don't think there's a better set of people to be discussing these things. So thank you.
Chris, I think that expression may be a little bit optimistic. Maybe if we made the union an intersection, we'd have something a little bit more realistic to talk about. Okay. Look, I think this talk and the whole meeting as a whole has been a wonderful illustration of the potential of this PR collaboration. Before we thank Chris, there's a few other people I'd like to ask you to join me in thanking. One, of course, is Guido. Who did most of the work in putting together this wonderful meeting in a rather short time frame, and the fact that everything was going so smoothly, we've had such a wonderful program, is a real tribute to his organizational skills. So thank you. I'd also like to thank Stuart, our AV guy. Most of you don't know this because you're not regulars here, but we have a lot of conferences here, and things always run very smoothly as far as all the organizations here at Tuscan go, and a lot of that is due to Stuart. So thank you, Stuart. And last but not least, I'd like to thank a group of people whose identities I don't know exactly. I didn't know that it contains, I know, for example, it contains Lucian and Chris, and it also contains Howard Burton. We've Guido and I first heard about this idea from Howard Burton when he was still director at PI. So the people I want to thank are basically the people at PI whose idea this was originally. So I'm very glad that the idea has come to fruition in this way, and thanks to all those people. Okay, and last but not least, thanks to Chris for a fascinating talk. Good, now we have tea outside.